buying, transporting, selling of slaves. And then you also describe in your book this this thing about kind of jails, not really jails, but holding pens in a way for slaves that could hold up to 100 at a time and had showrooms and all this kind of thing.
This is if you were to, you know, there's a document from New Orleans, I think it's in either 1852 or 1854, I can't remember right now, called the Census of Merchants. And they walked around the different neighborhoods of New Orleans, cataloging for the purpose of doing a new set of taxes. What are the various businesses? Well, there's a couple of neighborhoods in New Orleans where, you know, there is a very, very dense concentration of slave pens, is what they were called. And there, you know, there are anywhere from, you know, 10 to 100, 150 people for sale in each of these establishments at a time. There's, I think at the peak of the trade, there, you know, around 20 of them in the city of New Orleans. And people from downriver, in the sugar-producing parishes of Louisiana, and from upriver in the cotton-producing areas, sometimes all the way up to Arkansas, would come to New Orleans to buy slaves. Now, there were also a number of smaller, you know, markets all over the Deep South, and you know, Natchez is a fairly famous one at the forks of the road that there's been an effort to commemorate over the last decade or so. But, you know, really, any town with a courthouse, there were slave sales and legal, you know, estate sales and debt sales, so state-ordered sales, as well as retail sales, which are really what I'm talking about with the professional slave traders.
Yeah, and they had a way of grading the slaves as well, right, in terms of the women and the men, and people could come and examine you and all that.
Yeah, so there are a set of market categories that people use to set standard prices. You know, prime men, number one men, number two men, middling men, same categories for women. And these have to do with age and supposed vitality and skill. And some of those characteristics, vitality and skill, are somatically marked. They're attributed to people by and large on the basis of their skin color, whether they are dark or light or copper colored or coffee colored, or, you know, there's a million words that pop up in the slave market, in the paper ephemera of the slave market to describe people. That people are put on sale, and they are generally turned out for sale, somewhat surprisingly to me when I first saw this and saw documents that supported it. They're turned out for sale wearing, you know, often wearing full black suits, and women in long skirts and long sleeves and headscarves. And, you know, which was puzzling to me because I thought about the slave market as a place of degradation, which of course it was. But the first step in commodification is to try to make everybody look not like Henry Bibb from Missouri or Solomon Northup from New York or William Wells Brown, again from Missouri, but like a slave, you know, slave number 7.
Yeah.
So to have them sort of presented as identical. Well, then the buyers come in and they don't want to just buy a slave. They want to believe that they are buying the best slave. And that kind of dynamic between the uniformity that the sellers are trying to present and the specificity that the buyers are trying to pursue produces all kinds of conversations and inspections. People are asked to strip off their clothes, to show their scars, to talk about their skills, to talk about their pasts. And, you know, it is a gut-wrenching set of images.
Yeah.
It also, again, turns out to be that at the very inner workings of this economy, in the very interstices of all of this domination and subordination and exploitation, there's possibilities for enslaved people to to resist. And so you see, if you read 19th century slave narratives, the narrative of John Parker, which has recently been republished under the title His Promised Land, is fantastic on this, because Parker describes sitting in the slave market and evaluating the buyers and then presenting himself according to his estimation of the buyers, of who might, you know, for instance, who might live in New Orleans. Well, if somebody lives in New Orleans, then that might make it possible for him to get on a steamboat and get, as he eventually does, to Ohio. So there's this...
calculations on both sides.
There are calculations on both sides.
Yeah.
And, you know, and one wouldn't want to, you know, you don't say, well, it's insignificant that there's an internal slave trade and there's almost 1 million people sold because John Parker escapes, but nor can you tell the story, it seems to me, of that horrible forced migration without telling the story of John Parker.
And of resistance. Yeah, resistance and the fact that the slaves were perfectly capable of plotting and planning and resisting when that possibility was there. But also with these connected to the markets then would be the pricing, because there was a lot of information, right, in terms of determining pricing, because you've got like Maryland going all the way down to New Orleans, and pricing being, I imagine, varied, but also being set. I mean, how did that work? I mean, people can send a fax or an email, right?
Right. Well, yeah. There's a lot of information going back and forth between. Between the Deep South and the Upper South about what sorts of prices are being paid for slaves in New Orleans, and then that shapes what sorts of prices Upper South slaveholders are willing to pay. So, in one way, these letters that go back and forth are the first step in the commodification of people, in the process by which people are turned into products, because they can't send back and forth letters which contain all descriptions of the infinite variety of human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's these letters that go back and forth which depend upon these categories, prime, number one, number two, and so which produce the sort of imaginary idea that such a thing as a number one man exists and that people can be put into these categories. And it's that trick of imagination, commodification, upon which the slave trade depends and functions.
And I want to talk a bit about cotton. Our guest is Walter Johnson, author of this brand new book, River of Dark Dreams, Slavery and Empire in the Cotton Kingdom. And he is the Winthrop Professor of History and Professor of African and African American Studies at Harvard University. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And this is a 1 hour special and part of the work that we are doing on our show this year is the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. Right. One would not think so, given the lack of events marking this historic occasion. And Walter Johnson, there is so little is known about all of this. So little is known about the trade and the kind of detail that you go into, which is why I so very much appreciate this work. And as you know, the whole spectrum of what happened in this country, slavery and the slave trade and the building of global capitalism is very much underrated. And until, I believe, we really learn more about all of this, to confront it and to take the power relations as a result of this and the price people are paying for it, it's going to be very, very difficult for us to have any honest and serious conversation, not only conversation about race, but also even about basic economics and divisions in this country and in other parts of the world. Having said that, I want to ask you about cotton, right?
Mm-hmm.
in the land of cotton, right? There's songs about it. And, you know, my history comes from the Caribbean, you know, from Barbados. I was mentioning that to you, to you earlier, a slightly different, although brutal experience there. So tell us a bit about cotton, what was involved in the cultivation and the harvest of, because it's really difficult. And
it is very, it's brutal, very difficult. And so one of the things that has struck me as I've thought about the Mississippi Valley is the way that the instrumentalization of human beings and the instrumentalization of nature go hand in hand of cotton. And so in the 1820s, some planters in a place called Rodney, Mississippi, develop a hybrid strain of cotton, which has various names, but basically goes by the name Petit Gulf or Petit Gulf cotton. And the thing that makes that strain of cotton so popular is its, quote, pickability. That the cotton fiber, the boll, the sharp spikes around the cotton fiber, which is what the boll is, that opens up very wide, and the soft fibers inside are easily detached. And so, in a sense, what this hybrid strain of cotton is it's a plant that is engineered to the specifications of the human hand. Well, when we were talking about the slave market, really what slave buyers in the Mississippi Valley are interested in is human beings who are engineered to the specifications of the cotton crop. So what I'm trying to argue in part of the book is to think about the particular form that 19th century racism takes and relate it to the particular form of the economy. Now, enslaved people spend the majority of their waking lives in the Mississippi Valley cultivating cotton. Most people do. And that is backbreaking work. It is, you know, people are stooped over all day. They are working end-to-end across a field in what anyone who has been to Louisiana or Mississippi know is under intolerable white grinding sun that with combined with the humidity makes it, you know, difficult just to walk down the street. And then working sun up to sundown, as the saying goes, and then maybe taking a hour break in the middle of a day. Women would be able to nurse their children maybe once or twice in a day. There's descriptions of enslaved women working in fields with milk running out of their breasts. And so it's a situation in which I think that one of the things that I try to think about is that at some point in slavery, work and torture become indistinguishable. So we think about the bullwhip as the instrument of torture, and it certainly is. And then work itself is used as a punishment. People are forced to work brutal speed up, to run throughout the day to work, and really just the idea of working caked in dust, the cotton bowls, you know, cut up people's fingers. It is, I think, and I think this comes through the 19th century descriptions from ex-slave narrators, it is a form of torture.
It's difficult, I would have to say, you know, just thinking of what people went through, and I imagine for you just researching and reading this stuff. But the Mississippi Valley looked quite different when Native American people were there. I mean, there were forests, for example.
Right.
There weren't just these huge fields, right?
That's right.
Cotton fields. And that was part of what the slave labor had to do, right? Get rid of forests?
I mean, the first generation of enslaved people, you know, basically they cut down trees, or sometimes what they do is they girdle trees. They put a band of iron very tightly around the tree to kill the circulation through the tree, and then they, you know, then the tree falls down, and they often leave the stumps. I mean, there's descriptions of these fields planted in cotton that are full of stumps that nobody's taken time to pull the stumps out because they're so desperate to develop the economy. But really, when you today, if you get in an airplane and you fly over the middle part of the United States, you fly over the Mississippi Valley, then you can still see on the land the square pattern of the land office survey of the 19th century, the pattern by which native lands were expropriated, commodified, and sold off to the highest bidder. And the reason that you can see that pattern on the land, rather than simply seeing a whole bunch of trees, the reason that the stands of trees seem like interruptions in that landscape, rather than just the way that the landscape is because they were cleared by enslaved people. And so, you know, it's a very once you recognize what it is that you're looking at, when you look out the window of a plane, it's very present. It's a very, very stark reminder of the history of the United States of America as a whole. One of the things that I want us to think about is that the history of slavery didn't just happen in Mississippi. The history of slavery also happened in Massachusetts, right? The mills in Lowell are spinning cotton that's harvested by enslaved people in Mississippi, and I think that it's important for us to keep in mind the connections between industrial development and financial services and mercantile capital in the 19th century, you know, throughout the United States to the system of slavery.
Yeah, and also reaching across the pond, as they say, of the Atlantic, because the cotton that was being sold to Britain and in mills in Manchester or wherever else, I mean, is also connected here.
No, mostly yeah. In Manchester, and mm-hmm. and you're absolutely right that 85% of the cotton that is finished mm-hmm. in Manchester originated in the United States. So earlier I said that 85 to 95% of the cotton produced in the United States goes to the north of England, and correspondingly, 85% of the cotton processed in the north of England comes from the United States. And so these two poles, Mississippi and Manchester, Liverpool and Louisiana, are inextricably linked in the global capitalism of the 19th century. And I think one of the, you know, you started off the segment talking more generally about capitalism and globalization. And I think one of the things that has become important to me, one of the things that I've learned over the time of the too long a time of working on this book is to stop trying to think about slavery and capitalism as separate things. Mm. And the story that we've been told is the story that capitalism triumphs over slavery, that somehow the history of freedom is linked to the history of capitalism. And this is, you know, this is in some sense the founding mythology of capitalism in the United States, and I think really in the Atlantic world generally. Well, that's not true. You know, capitalism and slavery come into the world together. They are one thing, and that is certainly the case. There was no 19th century history of capitalism without slavery. The history of capitalism in Great Britain, or the history of capitalism in New York or in Baltimore or in Boston, was the history of slavery. They're one thing, not two.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and things are going very well for in the Mississippi Valley. A lot of money is being made, and you have just said slavery central to capitalism. You talk about the slaveocracy more integrated in the global economy than people generally realize. And sometimes I think that also what you just said might be the reason that in the United States, there is so little discussion, you know, about slavery and what happened and the details of what went into it and the money that was made, because then one would have to face it, wouldn't one?
In the United States, too often, the history of slavery gets told as the prehistory of freedom. And instead, I think that there are other ways. You know, that's not to say that the moment of emancipation isn't a revolutionary and world-making moment, but I think that there are other ways that we need to think about the persistence of slavery in the history of the United States.
Absolutely.
One of the most obvious ways is thinking through the persistence of the wealth and privilege, white privilege, created by enslaved people in very, very material terms. Right. Well, you know, what are the firms that exist today, or you know, the way that I was talking about the landscape of the Mississippi Valley? But there are, you know, we could talk about the fact that there's an exception, right in the heart of the 13th Amendment, the amendment that abolished slavery, is an exception, and that exception is people who are imprisoned are not covered by the protections of the 13th Amendment. Well, that's actually, I mean, maybe this is something that is generally known, but
no, it's not.
The most extraordinary fact that you have this unbelievable rate of black male incarceration in the United States,
mm-hmm.
and those people who are incarcerated are not covered, explicitly not covered by the amendment to the Constitution which abolished slavery. So.
Unbelievable.
It doesn't take a real leap of logic to say, well, so they can still be slaves? Are they slaves? You know, how do we think about that? So there are a lot of ways that I think it is important to try to think about the historical and material presence of slavery in our lives
today. Right, and the price we're paying today. And we discuss mass incarceration quite a bit, you know, on our show, and
sure.
including the fact that there are more black men incarcerated today than, I can't remember the exact year, in the 1800s of those who were
right.
who were enslaved.
Right.
It's just outrageous. But also, just on the history part of this now, things are going very well. The slave trade, cotton, a lot of money is being made in the United States, North and South, internationally on this. And, you know, there is the specter and the fear of the Haitian Revolution and, you know, the kind of black fear, I think they called it, in Cuba and other places after that,
right.
that revolution, and of slaveholders knowing that you have a population of people who are greatly oppressed and at any moment could rise up. And that happened in New Orleans back in 1811,
right.
you know, for example. And you know, there were some examples of pretty rebellious slaves. So there's that fear, and also the abolitionist discussion going on. So in your book, you talk then about how in the Mississippi Valley, of interest in expanding outside of the United States to places like
right.
like Cuba, and the story of this guy who actually invaded Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm. William Walker.
William right. Walker, right.
yeah. He became the sort of the self-appointed president of Nicaragua.
Yeah. So they had a global yeah. view also of expansion of slavery.
Did. They absolutely did. And they I think, you know, that there's two parts to that global view. And one we've talked about a fair amount, which is that they really believe that they are on the leading edge of history. That slavery is proving itself out as the motor of the global economy. But I think that you really importantly brought us back to the beginning of the conversation and the Haitian Revolution, because all of that boosterism and excitement is edged with fear.
Mm-hmm.
And at the most basic level, that is a fear of black capability, because slaveholders don't do anything for themselves. Right, I mean, that's what it is to be a slaveholder, is to have somebody else do everything for you. And so slaveholders in their daily lives depend upon the intelligence and physical capacity of enslaved people to survive. So you know, they know that these people aren't stupid. They know that these people aren't weak, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that I think starts to come through is their fear of their slaves, their fear of their slaves' capacity to to cooperate with one another, and to take all of that energy and strength and intelligence that is apparent from the fact that this society actually works through the stolen talents of enslaved people, and what would happen if they turned that against white people, as they do periodically throughout the history of the Western Hemisphere and the United States. And so this whole story is edged with fear. And that fear becomes, in the 1850s, particularly acute around the question of Cuba, because there is a fear that the Spanish Empire in Cuba is so weak that the British will come in and take over Cuba, and the British, by the 1850s, have long since abolished slavery and have become the greatest, as well as the greatest cotton-consuming country in the world, the greatest abolition-promoting country in the world. So there's a fascinating contradiction right at the heart of British history. This is what Eric Williams' amazing 1944 book Capitalism and Slavery is about. But the defenders of slavery, the advocates of slavery in the United States, are absolutely paranoid about the idea of British people taking over, the British taking over Cuba. And so they decide, and some of them in the Deep South decide in 1849 and then in 1851 to mount illegal, independent paramilitary invasions of Cuba to try to take it over and make it part of the United States. And that's the same sort of effort mounted by William Walker in 1856 in Nicaragua. Now, Nicaragua is particularly interesting to the advocates of slavery because there is a way in Nicaragua, particularly before the Panama Canal, to get between the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean. And so they believe that if they control Nicaragua, they really control the hinge of the global economy. And
wow.
They'll be able to connect the Mississippi Valley economy that we've been talking about to the to the Pacific, to California and to China. And they really they really do have a map for global domination.
Right, and having slaves in all of those areas. Well, Walter Johnson, I just looked at the clock and realized this has gone so quickly, and I've only talked with you about half of what I wanted to discuss, so we're going to need to have you back.
Oh, that'll be fun.
Yeah.
It's been a great conversation, and I really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you so very much, Walter Johnson.
Okay.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank Professor Johnson. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team. If you would like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Please like and friend us on Facebook if you are a member of Facebook, and check out our website at sotrueradio.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. It's about 2 minutes before 12 o'clock, time for the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, February 11th, 2019. Teachers in Denver are on strike today, and thousands of students and parents have joined them in a walkout in support of their demands. Teacher strikes have been successful recently in Los Angeles, West Virginia, Vancouver, Washington, and a number of other places around the country in recent months. The walkout comes after more than 15 months of tense negotiations between the school district and the teachers' union. Teachers say their salaries are too low for Denver's high cost of living and aren't keeping up with pay in neighboring districts. Denver has relied on a pay-for-performance model that began last year and has led to wide variations in teacher pay. But Denver teachers remain among the lowest paid in the country. City and state officials tried to stop the teachers from striking by threatening them with jail time. But as of today, more than 2,000 teachers are now picketing on the streets of Denver. A new report in the science journal Biological Conservation has found that the planet's insect populations are in a steep decline. The report clearly draws a connection between this mass extinction event and the heavy use of pesticides in agriculture. Professor Dave Goulson with the University of Sussex, who helped author the report, says the insect decline could result in a catastrophic collapse of nature's ecosystems if not addressed. Today is a crucial day for lawmakers in Washington to negotiate with the Trump White House to reach a deal before Friday's deadline would lead to another government shutdown. The previous shutdown, which lasted 35 days and ended on the 25th of January, was the longest in U.S. history. If a new agreement is not reached by both the House of Representatives and the Senate and signed by the president, a partial government shutdown will begin on Saturday. As Trump continues to push for a border wall, more horror stories have emerged this week showing how disorganized and chaotic this past year's family separation policy has been. Immigration officials reported that orders came from above with no framework to track families that were separated. Airport workers who were left without pay in December and January are gearing up for the possibility of another Trump shutdown. They've organized protests in more than 80 cities across the country if Trump refuses to budge and forces the government to close again this Saturday. Air traffic controller unions warned throughout the previous government shutdown that forcing airport employees to work without pay dramatically increases flight safety risks. That's it for the KBOO News at Noon. Tune in today and every weekday at 5 p.m. for more local, national, and international news produced by volunteer reporters right here in KBOO's Southeast Portland studios. For KBOO News at Noon, I'm Jenka Soderberg.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon.